This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon. I'm Tommy Bruce, the Vice President for University Communications, and I'm glad to welcome you to the 10th online conversation with President David Skorton. We've had a couple busy weeks full of emotion and some time off for the students, and so there's a lot to talk about. And without much further ado, Mr. President, I would like to turn the mic over to you.
Thanks, Tommy, and thanks, everybody, for being a part of this. It's a thrill for us that this is the 10th of these online conversations. And Tommy had the original idea for this, a very, very good idea, in my estimation, is a way to stay in touch more frequently with more alumni in a more intimate fashion, and also one that allows us to do it in a very cost-efficient manner. And we've gotten tremendous good help from predecessors of yours who have been on the earlier 9 online conversations. They've helped us to even more fully fine-tune the process. And it's turned out to be very, very good, at least from my point of view, and I know from Tommy's as well. So I appreciate the fact that you're here today. And while I'm thanking you, let me say how much I appreciate all that you're doing for Cornell. As Tommy said, it's been an emotional time. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. And talk about it for as much of the hour as you like. But what you do for Cornell in emotional times and times that are less emotional, what you do with your time and with your talents, with your generosity, mean a lot to me, never more than during a year like we are going through this year. Well, in terms of emotions, I have to say, having spent 31 years in higher education, 26 of those in the Pac-10 and the Big Ten. People ask me, as I was asked by some reporter in the not-too-distant past sometime last week, did you expect to be in the Sweet 16 in March Madness? And I said that you have a lot of expectations as an Ivy League president, Nobel Prizes, National Academies, not necessarily to be at the Sweet 16, but we were there. And I was so proud of everything about that team, about Coach Donahue and every one of the players and the terrific positive coverage and the dozens and dozens of places where alumni got together to watch both the Temple game and the Wisconsin game. And even our dear friend Biddy Martin, until quite recently provost at Cornell University, who's now chancellor at University of Wisconsin at Madison, was torn between which Big Red to cheer for. So it was really something, and it was wonderful. And as wonderful as that was, it wasn't by any means the only athletic prowess being shown off in this last period of time. Many of you who watched along with me in the women's ice hockey game in the for the national championship, if I have this right, Tommy, that was the longest women's ice hockey championship game in the history of the NCAA, going all the way to the end of the third overtime.
Yeah, third overtime, triple
before
overtime.
Before we were edged. And then, of course, the success of the men's ice hockey team and wrestling and polo, and it's just been a fantastic year for Cornell athletics. And talking about that reminds me of the enormous importance of things that happen outside the classroom, outside the studio, outside the laboratory in terms of the student experience, how much students learn from their fellow students, how much they learn, of course, obviously from the faculty, from staff members, and from the general environment on campus. And so athletics was a big boost to the students as well, a boost that we all needed after a challenging year. And I know that many of you, hopefully all of you, are aware of the very tragic set of circumstances that have occurred this year where we lost students for a variety of reasons. One student last fall to H1N1, and a student to an accident and other illnesses, and then several students who succumbed to suicide. And we have been very, very fortunate at Cornell for some years to have what is considered one of the top mental health programs and student support services in the country. When I was at the University of Iowa, we were well aware of the excellence of this program, and it is considered nationally the gold standard. Year in and year out, we have suicide rates at Cornell that are at or below the national average. But in a year like we just had this year, after over 3.5 years without a single suicide, to have a year with the number that we had this year was very difficult for the campus. And so it was terrific to have the support of Gannett Health Services and Janet Corson-Reichert, Greg Eels, Tim Marshall and their workers. It was wonderful to have the support of the greater alumni community. It was great to have the support of the happiness over these athletic events. And as so often, Tommy, the students show us the way forward. The students organized this Lift Your Spirits
event
about 10 days ago with over 1,000 students, put together through Facebook and other social network mechanisms, quick, in the course of about 36 hours, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
They put this together, and we had a chance to celebrate the spring together on this campus. Students have been gone for spring break. They're back now, and we're facing the future together in a positive Cornell kind of a way. So that's it. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. And Tommy and I want to hear whatever you want to ask us, and we want to talk about whatever you want to talk about. So welcome, and let's go ahead.
Absolutely. So just to remind everybody, at the lower left corner of your screen, there's a little icon with a waving icon. And if you want to ask a question, click on that, and that will indicate to me that you're ready to ask a live question over the telephone line. Also, you can I'll be monitoring the chat box right here below the screen. For those of you who would just like to type in a question for the president to answer. So with that, I can see that I have several live questions.
Great.
Callers.
Great.
Andrew Burr, would you like to be the first one to ask your question?
Andrew. Yes, good afternoon. This is Andrew Berger. I want to ask President Skorton about the ILR school, which is a gem at Cornell.
Sure.
But with declining state support, with budget problems at Cornell, and with a declining unionized population, can Cornell and should Cornell continue to support the ILR school, or is it a school that instead should be merged into, meld into, the rest of the university? Can Cornell therefore be, all things to all people, or should in this reimagining process that is taking place, possibly great schools like the ILR school be downsized or possibly even eliminated?
Well, the first thing to tell you is that if there ever was going to be a time to take a hard look at how we're organized, both in terms of academic organization, colleges, departments, curricula on the one hand, and in terms of our administrative support services on the other hand, this is the time. And Andrew, hopefully you're aware that the provost, Kent Fox, asked the dean of every single college to project forward how to operate that college in a excellent fashion, but in a revenue austere environment, and did some cross-cutting task forces to look at the way we're organized in areas where we have multiple perspectives on similar problems. And so the idea was to look very carefully at redundancies, at areas where we might think about changing the overall structure, and the provost is still in the process of looking at those task force reports and looking at the opinions of the faculty throughout the university. Tommy has set up, Vice President Bruce has set up, in the best traditions of public higher education, a very transparent process so that you can follow along with us as the campus is considering these kinds of issues. And there's a website that Tommy set up called Reimagining Cornell. It's right on the very front page of our web presence. I forgot always if it's the lower right-hand corner.
Lower left-hand corner.
Lower left-hand corner.
And it's
right. On the list of things, it says Cornell Leadership, right, and so on and so forth. It says Reimagining Cornell. You click on it, and you can look at the summaries of the task force reports and at the provost's initial response to those, suggesting which ones he's going to go forward with, which ones he's going to study a little bit more, which ones he wants to not go farther with. So that's the general answer. The specific answer is that I personally am not aware of any direct discussions about eliminating ILR. And my own take is that ILR is a very, very fine unit in curricular and in research areas and serves a very, very important function. That's not to say that in many different ways across the university, the provost is not considering how to reorganize delivery of academic services, that is, curricula and research and outreach. He is. And you'll see by looking in the Reimagining website the many, many, many ways and many different perspectives on the question that you brought up that he's considering. I'm not aware of any conversations, nor am I in favor of eliminating that college. I do want to say a couple things. It is true that union presence is different in the United States than it was some years ago. I come from a union family and have a lot of experience sitting on my grandpa's knee, so to speak, hearing about this, and have followed this closely over the years. But ILR, as you well know, Andrew, goes way beyond any such narrow focus. It's everything that touches, I think their tagline is, the world of work. And I found ILR to be a source of great good counsel and great scholarly work on a wide variety of workplace issues. And actually, in some ways, you might argue that during a recession, at a time of such upheaval, never do you need skills of a school like ILR more. The bigger issue you're raising, though, is should we look at how we're organized? Yes, we should, and it's being done. So thank you.
Alan Gordon, you're next up. What is your question for President Skorton?
Dr. Skorton, this is Alan Gordon in California. I would like to make a suggestion of something the university can do, simple, at no cost, that over time will bring an enormous return. When the material is sent out to incoming freshmen, include in it how they may access online The Builder, a biography of Ezra Cornell, and Cornell University Founders and the Founding. This is a point in the lives of these young people when their minds are focused on Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And if they read these books, they will be Cornellians for life.
It's a very, very interesting idea. And Tom and I are going to go back and share that right away with the people who are responsible for putting together all the materials for new students matriculating to Cornell. It's a very, very interesting idea. Excuse me, I had a little tickle this morning. I'm covering up the microphone.
So I would say that that fits very nicely with one of the initiatives that we have underway, which is to make easily accessible books by Cornellians,
right?
Our professors and others. We want to make. We're looking for ways to making that ubiquitous, and this would be a very nice way to lead the way.
Thank you for a very good idea. We'll be sharing it within the next day with the people responsible for putting
Thank
that
you.
Together. Thanks for a good idea. Alan, what part of California are you in?
Southern California, Ventura County, just outside Los Angeles.
Okay, because, you know, I went to Van Nuys High School. I grew up in Los Angeles.
I didn't know that.
To the extent that I did grow up, and we used to go to Ventura once in a while.
That's not very far from where I live.
No, we used to watch people surf near there in wetsuits at the middle of the winter.
Right.
Okay, who else? Who else? We have
Alice Berglass, would you please ask your question? Welcome
Alice,
aboard.
How wonderful to have you on the phone today. Thank you for doing this.
Hi, President Skorton, and to everybody else. It's an interesting question that Alan Gordon asked because it sort of flows into mine. I am always interested in how students and alumni and prospective students interact, whether students are invited to inaugurations, all of that. In that context, I have two questions. Knowing that the Alumni Admission Center is way off in a future hope, I am both thrilled and concerned about the news that Alumni House will be moving to Seneca Place. A lot of that makes enormous sense to me. I'm wondering if anyone, such as Heather Nichols or the Legacy Office or any one presence, will have a small home somewhere on the campus where alumni can drop in and have a real personal connection to the people who staff their parts of their lives. And in that context, too, was wondering always whether something like reunion could help with things, at least emotionally and lifting spirits, where things like the reunion run could actually have a purpose, whether it's using your feet for ears or all sorts of health, where alumni really can take something that wonderful on that weekend and really make it happen for the Carol Tatkin Center, your $10 for your T-shirts going to something that increases both the body and the mental health connection for students between alumni and students. And, you know, is there something wise and wonderful that's both subliminal and yet real that we can do with our feet? And in that same context, the other things that allow alumni to have a real face and handle both, so they have both a financial and an ambassadorial commitment when they're back at home. And they don't really tie together, but they absolutely do. So I'd love to know what's happening to the piece of Alumni House that would afford all of us to stay involved who come to visit when we're really there.
Alice, first of all, thanks. Almost every single time you and I talk, I end up, I always end up learning something from you, but almost every single time I also get an idea for a great initiative, something for the to-do list, as Tommy would say. So the idea of linking something to reunion weekend that would benefit the campus is fabulous. And we'll be talking about that with Chris Marshall and Charlie Flager forthwith.
Yeah,
that's just terrific. Tommy may want to comment on the issue about the Alumni Center and on-campus presence. It's a terrifically important point as well.
Right. My understanding is that there will be a place still on campus. But the fact of the matter is that the campus is available for everybody to come and participate. So I don't think that by having the staff, and I'm sure that Chris and others will be able to share with you their plans for, while working all together in Seneca Place, remain a vibrant part of the day-to-day life on campus. I think that's we're fully expecting that and looking forward to it.
And we need to get back to you, Alice, with some details, which we'll look into. I do know that there's going to be a presence on campus still, and I'm sorry that we can't give you a crisp answer on exactly what that is. The most important part of the issue is what Tommy said, in my opinion, and that is that, of course, they're going to be present on campus, but we're talking about access for you on campus, and we'll get back directly to you.
There are some specific ways in which I know Chris is addressing this, so we'll get back to you.
Thank you so
much.
Thank you for a great idea. I appreciate it.
Chris is actually online and responding to the question, which is saying we still have a campus presence, and we're working on the details now, so stay tuned, and we'll get to all of you with answers to that very specific question.
Now, you know, we could be a pretty good team because we just passed the ball around. So that I said to you, tell them what the answer is, and you said something going on, I'm going to ask Chris Marshall, and then Chris Marshall says we're working on it, stay tuned.
There you go.
That's not bad.
That's not bad.
That's not bad at all.
Time action. Larry Sondike writes saying, I've just returned my son to campus and saw the fence that's designed to make the bridges safer. Is there a happier, more attractive way to protect the bridges?
Well, let me talk to you about this. This is one of the very, very toughest decisions I've ever had to make in all the time I've been an administrator. And the short answer is, yes, there has to be a happier, more attractive way to protect the bridges, and we are working on that already. This unattractive, not a happy way to protect the bridges, was done because, based on research, not based on supposition or assumptions, but based on research, in multiple places, in multiple situations, so-called means restriction, taking away the means to follow a negative impulsive act all the way to an act of suicide, is very effective. Means restriction is very effective. And in areas in which such a thing can happen from a high place, like a bridge, it turns out that putting up barriers is an effective way to reduce suicides. And despite what you may think, it doesn't turn out that the people just find another way to do it or another place to jump or some other means to do it. It actually reduces one's ability to act on an impulse and then gives time for reconsideration, which occurs. So this is a temporary solution, a short-term solution for right now. Before the bridges even had these barriers put up, before they were even put up in the last week, we initiated the process of developing a longer-term solution, which, just as you say, would be a happier, more attractive way to protect people in terms of this impulse. And the head of facilities, the vice president for facility services, Q Wong, and the dean of the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, Kent Kleinman, and other professionals and faculty and students on campus are being brought together to discuss how to do this with all due haste, because our desire is to have this temporary solution be as temporary and short-lived as possible. So the answer is yes, we're thinking along the very same lines that you are. Thank you. And thank you for asking the question, Larry.
Thomas Foulkes, could you please join us and ask your question?
Okay. That last topic was certainly very sobering, and it sounds like some good steps. I just wanted to comment on Alice's idea of an alumni affairs presence on the campus. I recall back when the alumni house was first opened, and what a glorious thing that was. And even though we can have access to our colleges and other units of the campus, which those of us who are familiar with the campus do frequently, someone who is not there as frequently, the alumni house shows is a great place to start and to get some bearings in terms of where the campus is today.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, my it isn't a question, it's really rather an observation that I have. This is the new
Please.
Thought that I have. And it's a little strange because I'm not an athlete. I was not active in athletics at all at Cornell. I'm more musical, and music is what I've been active in all my life. But with the great fortunes of Steve Donahue and the basketball team and the hockey, and I'm thinking also of track, wrestling, lacrosse, where we have just had great records in recent years. So much of that's due to the athletes themselves, of course, and the coaches. But there's another person there that I think has just electrified Cornell athletics, and that's Andy Noel. And I hope you realize what a good job he is doing. And mm-hmm. and I'm old enough to have seen many in his in that chair. And I'm thinking he could be another Bob Kane. He's the most illustrious director of athletics we ever had.
Yep.
Andy is just doing an outstanding job, and I guess that's my comment.
I couldn't agree with you more about Andy. I've had a chance to work with a lot of athletic directors. In fact, when I was president at the University of Iowa, that particular peer group, it was most common. 80% of the time, the AD reported to the president of the university. So I had a direct reporting relationship in that peer group, which was common. Direct reporting relationship with the AD, and had a chance to work with many of them, and many of them very fine athletic directors. And Andy's right up at the top of the heap of people that I've had experience with. He's smart. He cares about the whole student experience, cares about the student and student athlete, knows what it takes, obviously, to recruit and retain superior coaches, and has dealt with a lot of challenges related to the changing landscape in financial aid, and therefore the changing landscape in recruiting of student athletes. And so, yes, I'm also a big fan. I share your very, very high regard for Andy, and also appreciate your comments about the alumni affairs presence on campus. And Tommy and I will definitely get more details out. Maybe, Tommy, if you don't mind, you can also share with Thomas
sure,
some of the details
absolutely.
That you receive.
Absolutely.
So thank you, believe me, we do very much appreciate Andy Noel, and we'll let him know about this as well. Thank you.
So we have Jay Taylor, who's been waiting to ask you a question live, and then
okay.
I think I'll go to a couple of these questions on that have been typed in and back and forth.
Sounds great.
Jay?
Thank you. And a quick comment and then a question. My comment is just to thank you for taking the time to speak with us and setting this up. I know it's been a difficult year for you and many on campus, both students and administrators. I just think you've done a remarkable, wonderful job dealing with it all, and I really can't think of how the university administration could have responded any better than you did, and so you continue to make me very proud to be an alumnus, and I thank you for that.
Thank you,
Jeff. My question, I was wondering if, as you're reimagining Cornell, if you could say something about the budget challenges we're facing in the shorter term, and maybe with specific focus on how you think the New York State budget situation will impact the statutory or contract units at Cornell. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for your extraordinary kindness. And if credit goes to anyone for how the administration is handling these very, very substantial challenges, it's Vice President Susan Murphy and Gannett Director Janet Corson-Reichert, CAPS Director Greg Eales, Director of Mental Health Initiatives Tim Marshall, this man right here, Tommy Bruce, and his crew for keeping people informed, as well as Mary Opperman and her crew in with the police, environmental health and safety, and many other people. It's been a big team effort, and we will share with all of them your regard. It'll mean a lot to them because it's been a very, very challenging, very, very challenging time. Now, in terms of your other comment and the reimagining Cornell and the budget issues, in general, I would say the provost, who is the budget officer for the university, both the provost in New York City and the provost in Ithaca, but specifically Kent Fox, the provost in Ithaca, has really done a very good job of a combination of some things that had to be done quickly, across-the-board actions that are not strategic in nature, but still began us on the trail back toward a balanced budget, and things that are very strategic, bringing in an international consulting company to help us streamline administrative services, the 20 academic task forces that we mentioned in response to an earlier question, Andrew Berger's question, and also the strategic plan, which is being worked on right now, and is also, by the way, on this website, Reimagining Cornell website, I believe, is where you can find the draft outline for the strategic plan. The reality that we're facing is that some of the revenue sources are going to be down for a while, and there's no better example of that than revenue from the state of New York. And I had the great, great honor of chairing a task force for the governor of New York on trying to diversify the state's economy based on partnerships, more robust partnerships between industry and universities throughout New York State. And in the process of learning more about the state's economy and interacting with the people responsible for pulling the levers in Albany, it turns out that it's a sobering fact of the challenges that the state is facing. And I believe that the only prudent way for us to plan, Jay, is for some years to come, reduced funding from the state. And it has come down a couple of years in a row. It may come down more. The state's in very dire straits. And so we need to find a way to deal with this reduced revenue source. In times where the revenue cutbacks were not as severe and didn't look to be as long-lasting as they're likely to be now, the general approach was for the contract colleges, the statutory colleges, to deal with them as they came. Last year, when it was clear that things were going to be more complicated than usual, the provost buffered, I think that's a fair word, Tommy, buffered the effect of the state downturn by having some of that reduction covered by the rest of the university, buffering the effects on the statutory colleges. And we're continuing with that kind of an approach. Now, the provost is coming up with a budget for next year. It isn't developed yet. He's still taking counsel and talking to a lot of people. But the general approach has been to look at taking some responsibility to deal with these state cuts outside of the strict bailiwick of the statutory colleges. And I applaud the provost's approach to that very, very strongly because of the, for two reasons, really. One is the very tight interconnections between different parts of this campus. We really cannot and should not wall off parts of the campus based on exactly where their funding comes from. That's one. And then secondly is that we are, as Tommy says, the land grant to the world, and the way we act as a land grant, even more broadly, of course, than the cooperative extension run so expertly out of CALS and so on, is that all of us have to take responsibility for outreach and public service. So for those two reasons, we're looking at, and the provost is looking at, and leading us to look at a broader, more holistic view of how we balance the budget. It certainly will affect, in a detrimental way, the funding for the contract colleges, no doubt about it. But we're working to buffer those effects as best we can, given all the other revenue streams that are down. That is, endowment earnings, philanthropy, and to some extent, other areas let's say, would not rise as quickly as they used to, like tuition. So that's a sort of a long-winded answer to a short question, but it's a very, very important one. And once again, as I mentioned to others on our call today, if you get a minute, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, to go to this Reimagining Cornell website, you'll have a pretty good idea of the kind of things that the provost and the strategic planning folks are thinking.
So we have several questions and comments that have stacked up on the online part. One is Patricia Ortenberg points out that we should, in reference to the bridges the fences, that we should maybe take a look at what's going on in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes.
So that's one thought for us. Another is Arcangela Da Silva is writing to us as a parent of a current student. She's concerned about having heard the wonderful things that Gannett has done. She is raising, saying, however, in reading about the events which led to the construction of the fences, it seems to me that at times the professors and deans are not as supportive and or understanding of the emotional issues which students may experience. What is the university doing to help with outreach and to increase the responsiveness and compassion of professors? One thing that has happened is that the provost and the dean of the faculty...
Exactly, I was just going to say that.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I have written to each of the members of the faculty, 1,500 strong, asking them to raise these issues directly during their classes. And I'm sure that I will share your question, Ms. Da Silva, with both the provost and the dean of faculty to see if there's other things that they might want to do as part of their ongoing efforts to reach out to professors on this issue.
In fact, to restate it just a little differently, but to basically underscore the same point that you're raising, Patricia, is it?
Yeah.
And that Tommy commented on, a very, very, very broad, excuse me, I got the name.
It's Arcangela.
Arcangela, please forgive me. A broad holistic approach to supporting our students is the only way to go forward now. We have to go forward, of course, with the best mental health services and best health services. We have to go forward in a very positive way with a lot of student life activities, a lot of upbeat, strong things to help everyone continue to look forward. We have to help everyone to lower the stigma for going for help when we need it. All of us in our lives, everyone I've ever met, myself included, has needed help at certain times. And to lower the stigma for getting that help is very important. Looking at the classroom experience, thinking about the advising system and everything that touches the students, we have to look at in a very holistic fashion. And to our colleague who mentioned about the Golden Gate Bridge, that is one of the studies that I mentioned before. There's actually quite a bit of data to suggest that barriers on bridges are effective means of reducing suicide. So thanks for reinforcing those ideas. We're definitely with you on that.
Absolutely. So let's go back to the telephone, and I think I have Helene Maccabee-Rose, who's been waiting very patiently to ask you a question.
Helene, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. It's Helene Maccabee-Rose. I came to Cornell from the Chicago metropolitan area, and I now live in Southern California in Pasadena. I was a graduate of the Arts and Sciences College, and I just had the pleasure of participating in a luncheon with the dean of the Cornell Law School. I'm not an attorney. I was a mathematician and an information systems specialist and other things. My questions, and I want to compliment you and your whole team. I think you're doing a phenomenal job. I want to focus more on new students and applicants, and that is, when will all of the acceptances be out to current applicants as undergraduates at Cornell? And does that depend on what college they've applied to, number one? Number two, is it true that there are co-ed dorms and that they're mandatory? That's what I've heard. And three, I'm very concerned about the applicant whose parents, one or both of them, work very hard. They're both professionals. They may not have gone to Cornell, but they're earning a good living, but facing $250,000 for 4 years at Cornell, and then with another child who's 15 in a few more years, is rather daunting, to say the least, and it's very discouraging. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of financial help to people other than poor people and whose parents aren't doing well.
Okay. Well, thank you. So a lot of issues. Let me touch on a couple of them, and we can follow up afterwards if we don't hit them all. In terms of the results of the admissions process, they're going to be very, very soon. And the number of applicants is astounding. This year went up another 5% to over 36,000 applicants for the roughly 3,000 spots that we have. So very, very competitive process. Those results will be out very soon. If I understood correctly, we had a little bit of static on the line. Were you asking about co-ed dorms?
Fine.
Okay. Except for Balch, one of the North Campus residence halls that is limited to women, so far as I know, the other ones are all co-educational. And we do make it mandatory that all the freshmen live on the North Campus. My wife and I stay on the North Campus every year. We are going to be doing our fifth time coming up this fall. We stay during orientation week. And I think that was a terrific decision on part of the university administration in years gone by, recent years gone by, to create a combined, coordinated freshman experience by having people live in those dormitories. In terms of financial aid, that's a topic very, very close to my heart. You are right that, if I can paraphrase, some people who are well above the poverty level, well into the middle class, still will have a tough time affording a very substantial tuition. So we're doing two things about that. One is we've had an enormous, enormous increase in our financial aid, and we are hoping for the, to be very straightforward with you, the philanthropic support of alumni who have gone through this university to help us keep that path paved for those who are coming afterwards so that we can maintain a very, very robust financial aid that we now have that has allowed us to be more and more diverse, and we're the sixth most economically diverse school of our caliber in the United States, and as only one measure, have the most racially diverse freshman class in the history of the university right now. Secondly, besides the robust financial aid, we're attenuating the rate of rise of tuition. Still, it's substantial, but the last couple of years have been the lowest increases in tuition on the endowed side of the university, which is most of the students, the lowest in about four decades, a little over four decades. So we hear you loud and clear, and I hope I touched on most of the answers. Thank you for those questions.
We'll follow up.
We will follow up.
Ken Gao, speaking of fundraising issues and so forth,
yes.
His question is in regards to alumni participation at the Johnson School. Being an MBA graduate, he is a little disappointed in the participation rates in fundraising. In his opinion, 15 to 20% suggests that, as he says to me, that the school is losing connection with valuable resources, the graduates. What can be done to improve this? Sometimes I believe the school forgets that graduates have a lot to offer and is too interested in big checks rather than getting greater participation.
Well, I agree with you in every single aspect of what you said. Participation, I hope, will get higher. We need to find better ways to be available to alumni and to reach out directly. Two different things. Be available and be responsive to questions and concerns and offers of help of any kind. And secondly, reach out. Tommy and Chris Marshall's fabulous idea to have these, what do you call them?
These online conversations.
No, there's another word you use.
Webinars.
Webinars, I'm sorry. Let me take that back. To have these webinars is one way of reaching out, and many, many others that we're doing. So I absolutely agree. And finally, what you mentioned about the size of the gifts not being the only thing to focus on, I couldn't agree with you more. Most, the vast majority of people who contribute to Cornell or any university do so at a level that's far below the enormous, enormous generosity of a few fortunate people who have the tremendous desire and connection with Cornell to share as generously as they do. Of course, we depend on these very large gifts, but we depend just as much on the smaller but still critical gifts of people throughout the spectrum. And I'm not saying that for the occasion. It's absolutely true, and mathematically it's true too. So we need to be more responsive, to reach out more, and this is just one small example, this webinar, one small example of ways that we're trying to do that. And that award-winning team of Chris Marshall and Tommy Bruce are finding many, many ways to reach out. If you have ideas, not just you, Ken, but anybody on the phone, by speaking to us now, or if we can't get everybody's voice on, by email, to david.scorton@cornell.edu. We'd love to hear your ideas, and we will take every single one seriously because this is very important for our future, very important. So thank you, Ken.
I would like to just bring in Jean Sanders. She has a question here, which let me just read it. It's happier, more attractive measures to protect bridges, buildings, students, et cetera, always cost money. Please comment on the bigger picture. What is the financial situation of the year?
Okay, I'll tell you about it.
This year, I mean.
Yep, thank you. I'm just writing it down so I remember to get the answer somewhat related to the question, which Tommy insists on. The university's budget, just to remind you, is over $3 billion a year, about two-thirds of it in Ithaca, call it a bit over $2 billion, and a bit over $1 billion at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Of this $2 billion annual expenditures, without other actions, without the bold moves that the provost is leading us by, we were on the path toward developing a deficit of over $200 million a year, so give or take 10% of the total budget of the Ithaca campus. And we never were anywhere near that number because we started to do things. And the in-year operating deficit, the in-year budget for this particular year, the operating deficit, we're going to end the year somewhere around $60 million, $60 million on total operating expenses of about $2 billion. So it's a relatively small percentage, but a very important that we balance the budget, and we're well on the way toward balancing it. We have every hopes of getting that down to about half that size by next year and then to zero. And it's being done by a combination of many, many maneuvers. Last year had a voluntary staff retirement incentive that a very large number of staff, over 400, chose voluntarily to take this incentive and leave the university. We also had layoffs last year and are continuing to have them this year. We also have reduced the payout from the endowment that goes to the individual units to match the fact that the endowment itself is down so that we don't continue to dig into the corpus of the endowment. And we have cut back construction on campus enormously to reduce our growing debt and many other maneuvers that have been done. And these things in the aggregate began to reduce the deficit right away. In addition to that, we did bring in an international consulting firm, and they are helping us to reduce the cost of administrative support. The university was never bloated or anything like that, but this is a tough era, and we are reducing even further. Even organizations that are lean, we're reducing more. Tommy runs one such organization. I run one such organization. I eliminated two vice presidencies from the university, just eliminated the positions. So we will have two fewer vice presidents. And trickling all the way through the system, procurement, how we do communications, how we support HR services, how we support information technology services, we're doing all of those, and so far quite successfully. In the process of balancing the budget, of course, we need to protect the key asset of the university, and that is its people. We're doing our best to find that right balance. Thanks, Gene, for the question. Thanks for being on the call today.
So I'd like to invite a couple of our callers who've been waiting patiently. Susan Stragak has been waiting to ask you a question over live. So, Susan, could you please go ahead?
Where's this?
I certainly will. President Scorton, I'd like to thank you very much for being here. And you and your team, I think, have done a wonderful job. Here's my question. Over the years, we've witnessed a lot of student unrest at Cornell and other universities all over the country, and the most famous at Cornell, of course, being the takeover of Willard Straight Hall, which I was able to see from the window of Sage Hall where I was working at the time on campus. There's so much controversy today over so many issues, healthcare, the economy, the Middle East, the wars in Iran and Afghanistan, to name a few. What measures does Cornell have in place to ensure a free and open campus and minimize the possibility of another takeover?
Well, this is a really, really important question, and bear with me, Tommy. It deserves a three-dimensional answer.
Sure, absolutely.
So all over the world, as long as I have been aware of it and read the history of higher education and been involved in a little bit of it myself, it's clear that students lead the way to a lot of major changes in our institutions based on their own sensibilities, what they want in a university, what they want in a curriculum, what they want the university to represent and to do. And so if that dialogue occurs in the right way and is effective and constructive, it's hugely, hugely important for us, for the institutional leaders, and for the institution itself, and for the students who are here, as well as the faculty and staff, to not only have or tolerate, I would say, a dialogue, but to foster it, to push hard for dialogue. One hopes that it will never again occur at Cornell that communication is perceived as being inadequate, insufficient, and so that people would resort to the difficult means that were resorted to in the past. And we have done a lot prior to my time at Cornell, and I hope in retrospect people will see that it went on in my time as well, done a lot to try to increase the discussion across the campus to students, to faculty, to staff, throughout the university. And here's some of the things that we're doing. Let me first quickly talk about faculty and staff. I meet on a regular basis with the University Faculty Council, sort of executive committee of the Faculty Senate. I hope that's a fair way to characterize the UFC. I meet through Tommy's good offices with University Assembly, which are the leaders of all of the assemblies, Faculty Senate, as well as the Student Assembly, the undergraduate representational body, the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, and the Employee Assembly. I also meet separately with the Employee Assembly. And then in terms of students, besides meeting with the Student Assembly and the Graduate Professional Student Assembly, I meet with the leaders of all major aspects of student life, the head of the Greek system, as well as the other representational groups, including those representing PhD and MD students at Weill Cornell Medical College. Tommy and I meet about monthly with the editorial board of the Cornell Daily Sun, which is going to happen in about 2.5 hours today. And that's another way of interacting with the students. And we also have Vice President Susan Murphy and Dean of Students Kent Hubble and I have office hours for undergraduates and graduate students in my office periodically. And, of course, we respond with willingness and with a relish to come and talk to people in brown bag lunches and town hall meetings across the campus. And, in fact, Tommy and Kent Fox and Ed Lawler, who's leading the strategic planning process, and Mary Opperman, the VP for Human Resources, and Kent Fox and others have fostered, I don't want to exaggerate, but 3-4 dozen of such opportunities this year. I think 40 alone, maybe, related to the strategic plan.
Yeah, I think we've gone over 40 at this point.
And so dozens of these opportunities. Now, whether or not this is getting the job done, we're only going to be able to tell in retrospect by looking back at these years. My impression from talking to the leaders, not only the leaders who work with me, like Tommy, but the leaders of these shared governance groups, is that whether or not they agree with every one of our decisions, and I assure you they don't, that they appreciate the transparency and the openness of communication.
I think the Sun has editorialized to that extent.
Yeah, the
on
Sun,
a number of occasions,
the Sun
which
has.
Is unusual.
But it's never something to be complacent about. Never, never, never. So thank you for that. Very important, thoughtful question.
So we have one, another caller, Carl Gruskauf-Manis, who is online. Would you like to ask your question,
Carl,
please?
You said? Carl. Okay.
Carl.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for making this venue available. I guess the short question I had is, given some of the challenges the school has faced this year, I expect there may be a number of us as alumni who would like to lend a hand to the process of recruiting this class, for which you mentioned the impressive statistics. And I know that I'd received some messages in the past with respect to that, but if someone wanted to open their house for a reception or something to that effect, who's the point person, and a corollary to that or another part is, are we adjusting our recruitment efforts at all this year?
We have continuously been adjusting recruitment efforts, up adjusting them to take more and more advantage of this kind of generosity. And, you know, I'm embarrassed. Usually I have an answer, or at least a facsimile of an answer. I'm not sure if the point person is the director of admissions or if it's Chris Marshall or some combination of the two.
To talk to both of them.
Yeah. But can we get back to you, Carl, and let you know? And Tommy, I would ask you, if you don't mind, if we could send it out to everybody.
Sure.
It's a great question, and I'm embarrassed and sorry I can't tell you the best point of initial contact. I think it's going to turn out to be the admissions office, which runs the recruitment, which is in the provost office, but we'll let you know. In fact, the way it works, though, is that these opportunities and the tremendously generous offer that you're making, when taking you up on these generous offers, these two organizations, the Alumni Association on the one hand and the admissions machine on the other, work together. But I don't know actually.
So as we're listening, Jennifer Cunningham, who works in Chris Marshall's office, suggests that Kyle Downey in admissions is the contact person.
Oh, very good. So it is somebody in admissions named Kyle Downey. And Jennifer, thank you very much for making up for my shortcomings here. That's great. And she will post his email soon. So it is admissions. And we need your help. We want your help. And we never take it for granted that we're going to continue to have this torrent of interest in Cornell. We want the torrent to get bigger and bigger. We want to be considered again and again the hottest Ivy, as we were named by Newsweek.
Absolutely.
And even though they didn't do that hottest Ivy thing again this year, I don't think anybody was named.
After they named us, I think.
Where can you go after that?
There you go.
We know we're the hottest Ivy. We know we are. On and off the basketball court.
So I have a couple, there have been a couple of exchanges here that have sort of resulted, but I don't want to reflect them. Allison French and Richard Irali have been talking about getting Corey Earle for the development office out to make some presentations in Washington and elsewhere. And I think Jennifer's been discussing it online with them as we've been talking.
Jennifer's our secret silent weapon here, as we know.
So I do have a couple of folks, so I just wanted everybody to know there's a good conversation exchange going on there.
Good.
Cynthia Kubas is a CAN member, and she says that she is sorry to hear that Doris Davis will be leaving Cornell. Would you address the process which will ensue to find a new admissions leader?
Yes, the admissions office, rather, is in the provost area, and I know for a fact by some email exchanges in the last 36 hours that Provost Fox is actively working on exactly how the process will work of searching for and successfully finding a new person to lead this hugely busy and critical office. I do know that Doris has agreed, and perhaps Tommy would know, to stay on for a bit in a transition period until the end of the fiscal year.
Until the end of the fiscal year.
And so I know the provost is working apace at finding the next director of admissions. Very, very, very challenging job right now, the whole admissions financial aid area, for all the reasons that have been brought out on this webinar today.
Absolutely.
You see, webinar, I remembered the word.
There you go. We have a question from Richard Irali, who was talking about Corey Earle. It also has another issue. In the March issue of the Ithaca Journal, there appeared an article that dealt with the soaring tax base for the villages of Tompkins County. Since the bulk of the very supportive and much appreciated staff of Cornell live in these villages, is there a chance that this noted increase in tax levies will induce an exodus from our county that would or could result in acute loss of support people?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. I sure don't have a crystal ball about that. We worry about that in all parts of the United States. Every municipality that has a high tax rate worries about this. I know the whole state of New York worries about it in terms of the overall tax burden in New York. I don't think there's any evidence so far that that's happening in large numbers in Tompkins County, but I'm not really on top of all the data in that regard. Tommy, do you have a point of view on that?
My point of view would be that all of us who live here in Tompkins County come and live here for a good reason. It's a beautiful place to live.
Yes.
And so therefore, I don't think that we uproot ourselves so easily, though obviously the financial situation that affects everybody is affecting us as well. So I think there's a reason to think that Ithacans will hang in there and stay together.
Well, one of the interesting things about Tompkins County, as is the case in many college towns that have robust local and regional economies, is that the unemployment rate is lower here. Many aspects of the quality of life are better, which is just what Tommy was alluding to when he said it's a beautiful place to live. I know that he meant more than visually beautiful, but we also shouldn't be complacent about the fact that that balance between tax burden and people's willingness to stay is always an issue.
And
always an issue.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you go out in the community, you realize that not only is Cornell active, but Cornellians are very
as
active
individuals,
and are, as individuals are deeply committed to the welfare and the improvement of the community. So I think that we're all in there working this issue.
You know, here's a couple examples of that. Let me just quickly say this because I'm so proud of things that people around me are doing. So Tommy's wife, Connie Bruce, for example, very, very active voice and activist in a positive sense in the community. People who work at the university who participate in leading the university's Peace of United Way campaign and helped me in the last few
years.
Steve Golding.
David Harris is here.
Yeah, and who's coming up?
I think Joanne DiStefano is
Joanne DiStefano. I know Mary Opperman maybe has been involved in
Susan
it.
Susan Murphy has
Susan
been involved.
Murphy. Yeah. People who work on other kinds of nonprofits, the glue that keeps the university together. Help me with this.
So I think that
many examples.
I mean, I think
so I think that that outreach is very important,
absolutely.
Contributing to the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so therefore, I mean, to Richard's question, I think that every community in America must be worried about this.
Yeah.
These circumstances, and that in of itself does. I mean, it sort of would temper people's desire to leave. Simply because
there's so much that they're engaged with here. It might
exactly.
even be fun sometime for you and me to try to compile some of the interstices, some of the
absolutely.
Tentacles that go out of the community.
I think absolutely.
That was good. Thank you, Richard.
So we just have a couple minutes left here
okay.
at this point, and I think that we have...
how about that last one? What another thing?
We just got a very large one in here.
Chag Samea.
Samea, President. Are you still getting time for the saxophone?
First of all, thank you for being very, very thoughtful with the Chag Sameach. This evening, we're going to have the second chance for a Seder, for Passover, and it's wonderful to be in a community and in a larger community where people are always recognizing all of our various traditions,
mm-hmm.
and
it's a joyful
time. I especially like it, by the way, this time of year where it happens very close to Easter because of the linkage, as you know, the Last Supper,
absolutely.
The Passover Seder. So thank you very much. In terms of the saxophone, I do play it a bit for the sake of the hearing of our entire community. I've cut back a little bit so as not to cause sonic pollution, but I am playing, and I've gone back to tenor saxophone, which was the original saxophone that I played, and I'm playing it behind closed doors now as I'm returning my embouchure to shape for the tenor saxophone. And I'm going to close the curtain of charity on that.
So that gives me a really nice lead-in to do a little promo for the Sunday Forum
this Sunday.
WVBR. President Scorton will be joining my show, Sunday Forum, to spin a few records, some of his preferred jazz music. We have one last question or comment from Alice Berglass. A hugely fragile time for students, particularly freshmen in Stanford, is a time of housing decisions, and most particularly rush week. It is a time of possible fabulous peer success and for some peer rejection.
Mm-hmm.
That winter time of year of essentially empty campus and singular Greek life opens doors to depression and singular view of Cornell life. The fall and immediate spring term need to have organizations like the Daily Sun, singing groups, WVBR, student
here.
Government, etc. need to come back with spring strong and active new recruiting so that students
yep.
who do not get
here,
get
here.
In or get have an opportunity to join.
Alice is honestly not trying to butter you up too much, Alice, but you're always the voice of reason and the voice of positive engagement toward the future. We're thinking about a lot of these issues. Tommy, Susan Murphy, many, many people across the campus. What a wonderful way to end today's discussion. And on Alice's very, very positive note, I want to thank everybody for being with us. I want to remind you that we're going to get back with you on some of these issues. We do have the name of the person in admissions
absolutely.
Who can be contacted, Kyle Downey, and we're going to...
Kyle Downey, and his email is kmd44@cornell.edu.
I also want to comment that after we mentioned the ball being passed around on the issue of Alumni House presence on campus, Chris Marshall did write back again
Absolutely.
And say that things rolled downhill.
He's on top of
He said things rolled downhill.
Absolutely.
I want you to know what that is. I also want to remind you how to get a hold of us should questions come up afterwards that we didn't cover or you want to follow up more. TWB22@cornell.edu and David.Skorton@cornell.edu. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for being a part of this, and thank you for being a part of Cornell. And go Big Red.
And one last little promo talking of Go Big Red. On Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on Cornell Cast, there's a fresh interview of our coaches, each of our coaches, every week. So go to Cornell Cast off of Cornell.edu and see Blaine Friedlander from the press office interview a coach of the week.
Thanks for being with us.
Take care.